All right, is this thing on? Yeah, sounds good. I'm going to go get a stool. We'll make it really informal. So think of your questions while I'm coming back. This is not God. This is me talking. Okay, now. All right. I really want to kind of keep this informal. Hearing Jamal sing reminded me that some stadiums I would go to, they'd always play a song right before it, and I never hit good after they played that song. Anybody know what song it was? No, National Anthem. Anyway. So, all right. Who's got the first question? I don't think we need a mic. I think we can, I just have a tough time seeing with a spotlight. Who's got the first question? Red shirt, first hand up.
What was your favorite teammate?
My favorite teammate ever?
Yeah.
See, I say who it is, and then people will be like, I don't remember. Pete Orr was my favorite teammate ever. People are like, oh, Pete Orr, kind of maybe... Little guy, didn't play real well for the Philly, you know, great teammate. He was actually not, he's not a Christian guy, which I always like to tell people. You know, I think he showed me a lot about being a great person to other people and loving other people. And he didn't even have the love of Christ in him. So I think it really checked my life that love looks different to other people. And sometimes as Christians, I can be judgmental of non-Christians, and he's my favorite teammate. My favorite superstar teammate, everyone's like, oh, okay, yeah, yeah. Aaron Judge was my favorite superstar teammate. He treated my kids like absolute gold. It was like, I mean, for me, growing up, Ken Griffey Jr. was like, obviously Mike Schmidt was really cool, but then he retired and I was still a kid. So, like, Ken Griffey Jr. was the guy. Well, what Ken Griffey Jr. was to me and my buddies, Aaron Judge is to my son and his buddies. And then I got traded to the Yankees, and my locker was right next to him, and he was just like, hi, hi. It was, like, the only time he didn't have words to say. But, yeah, so I always say Pete Orr, and then I say superstar teammate Aaron Judge.
I had a question.
Go ahead.
Can you bring Aaron Judge as our speaker next year or no?
That would be a little bit tough. You had to have better security. Let's put it this way. And it's a really, really good question. Probably not going to happen. But it is something that a guy like that, it's so amazing to see when you're in a clubhouse and you see a guy who's a Christian man, young man, at the time when I started playing with him, single, and the stuff he has to go through that I don't have to go through, and he still plays better than me, it shows you how really good they are. You know, those guys, every single day, he comes into the clubhouse in spring training. This is spring training, just practice, not a game, just practice. And he sits down at his locker, taking his big size 17 shoes off, and there's just a horde of reporters just gathering around. He's got to stand up. I couldn't have done this at 23, 24 years old. Stands up, interviews with them, they disperse. Okay, and there's a couple stragglers that hang around and they're like, try to ask him a question because he's the guy. Like, he's Aaron Judge. And he's very cordial with them. He doesn't give them too long of answers. And then he's walking to the door to go to the weight room. The door's probably from me to the piano. A coach stops him. Hey, did you check out the schedule? You know, the coach, like, Coach, the schedule's right there. Like, he could have checked out the schedule. You don't need to talk to him. He just has that personality where, like, people gravitate to him. Then I followed him just because I'm, like, I'm a people watcher. So I'm watching as he's, like, I see him go to the cage. Two minor leaguers that hadn't been in big league camp yet stop him and are like, hey, what's up, man? You know, probably doesn't even know him real well, but they want to know him. Almost made it into the weight room. Hitting coach stops him. Hey, did you think about what we talked about last night? It's like, uncle, like, this guy has so much on his plate, and then he has to go out and perform. So if you ever see your favorite players not doing well, give him a break. Like, give him a break, just a little bit of grace. Especially as Christians, we gotta give a lot of people grace. But anyway, who's next? Yes. I didn't talk about much about my defensive. I guess so. I guess it's one of those things. It's one of my self-deprecating qualities. I feel like I was pretty good defensively, so when I talk about it, I feel arrogant, so I just kind of gloss over it. But it's one of those things. Defensively, you're right. I was in the big leagues for a while because of my defense. You hit whatever I hit in the big leagues, and you probably have to play a decent defense. But it was also the position allowed me to. If I was equally as good in the outfield or, you know, at third base, my defense wouldn't have kept me in the big leagues. The position's a premier position, and the teams that win have good catching. And I think it was the teams that really wanted to be in the playoffs knew that catching depth was a big thing. So that was something that it did. It kept me around for a while. Go ahead.
Eric, you're a big guy.
Okay.
So at home plate, when you're blocking the plate and the base runner's coming from third, right? Any collisions?
Any collisions? Yeah, that should have been on my the video. I had a couple collisions. The first one in the big leagues, the first one was Prince Fielder. And everyone's like, yeah, like he was fast too. I mean, that was 300-pound bowling ball coming in there. He was not. I found out later in my career in 2018 when I was with the Brewers, he came back as like a Brewer legend, throw out a first pitch. I thought it'd be funny to put on all of our video screens in our video room, which is probably about 6 to 8 screens, the collision at home plate because he tried to run me over, and I caught it in time, and I tried to lay the boom, and it kind of knocked me backwards, but I stayed on my feet, and he was laying on the ground. So it made me look like a boss. And so I let it run on the screen. Well, he never saw it, because our video guy was like, oh my gosh, if he sees it, he's going to think it's me. He was afraid he was going to come in and just be like, and just knock him to the ground. But our bench coach, who's a real fire starter, he liked poking the bear, he comes out before he throws the first pitch. He's like, hey, have you met Eric Kratz? And he's like, yeah, I really don't like him that much. So I don't know if he saw the video or not, but then I also had a collision with Chipper Jones. They're both good collisions. They're both good. Chipper, I didn't think it was his last year. I didn't think he'd run me over. I thought he'd try to slide underneath me. And it was like instantaneous, boom, boom, knock my mask off. And I remember everything went like really small, like, and I had vision, like just super tunnel vision. And I picked my helmet up because it was right next to me. I didn't see it. I remember picking it up, and the umpire says, show me the ball. And I showed him the ball, and I just started jogging off. And all I could see was Charlie Manuel and his like gnarled fingers giving me a high five. We never knew how to give Charlie Manuel a high five, because it's like, how do you give a rake a high five? Like, you know, it's like, you know, you give him something long, but, and he was just like, yeah, good job. Like, you did a good job. And as soon as I gave him a high five and I got in a dugout, it was like, whoop, everything came back in. It wasn't a concussion, okay? It wasn't a concussion. But I ended up hitting a home run that game, so I couldn't have been that concussed. Or maybe I was, and I should have played more concussed. One of the two. But then they changed the rule, and so, done. Yes.
Could you talk about some of the leaders that you served under, some of the managers?
Yeah. And that's a good question. If any guys in here, some of the leaders and coaches that I played under. The coaches, like especially if you have kids or grandkids and they're like, oh, my coach is terrible. I learned early on, and it was in college summer ball, that even bad coaches you can learn from. Because you can learn how not to be. Like, if you don't think they're that way, make sure you don't get that way. So I learned that early. And everybody thinks, oh, big league manager's got to be the best. And they're not all. They're not all that great. Some of them have just put in their time, right place, that kind of thing. But some of the guys that really impacted my life, impacted my baseball career, were 100% the guys who the situation never got too big for them. It stayed, you know, their emotions stayed here. Now they got excited, but they never got too low. And it was something that a consistent approach to each day on the field, you know, so you talk about in the big leagues, Charlie Manuel, you talk about Craig Counsell, you talk about Joe Girardi, you talk about, you know, even Aaron Boone, incredible incredibly just the way that they go about interacting with the guys on the team as not just commodities and not like underlings. AJ Hinch was that way too. All guys that really influenced how I interacted with people, which I think is being a leader, which is being a teacher, which is being a coach or a manager. But early on in my career, there was two guys that really influenced my catching, Mike Basso and Ernie Witt. Some of you probably have heard of Ernie Witt. He played for the Braves. He played for the Blue Jays. But they taught me a lot about catching. But they also taught me baseball. I feel like baseball players are all right here. You know, everybody's, what sets you above? And each of them would talk about your dedication. They talk about your ability, yes, but very few people have just elite ability. They're not here. Those guys are here. They're the outliers. So it's the dedication, but it's the attention to detail for others. And if you're doing something for somebody else, and these guys weren't Christian men, these guys weren't, you know, they weren't living their life for the Lord, but what they were saying was so important. Like, if you're doing something for somebody else, very seldom are you going to be like, eh, whatever. No, you're like, man, I can't let that person down. I can't. I gotta do the best I can. I got to put everything I have into it for them. It's fortunate that a catching position that is paramount. So it was something that those were life lessons and things that they taught me that were really huge in my pro career. Yes. Yeah. There was? I got traded from there, stinking Ruben Morrow. Probably not with the Phillies. Maybe. I don't know. I mean, I played a decent amount when I was with the Phillies for compared to other places. When I was with the Brewers, there were some guys that liked throwing to me, and I had a bond with those guys. But the question about knowing what pitches to call. The best pitch to call is the one that gets the guy out. Doesn't matter. If they hit a home run, like, what were you doing? Like, what's your problem? But it really, it's a ton of extra work. Like, just give you an idea of a normal day for me. I would get to the field 12:30, somewhere in there, for a 7 o'clock game. And I would go and let's take a day where I wasn't playing. Let's say I'm not playing the first game of a series. First game of a series is extra scouting report work. The team is doing their own scouting reports, but if you just go by what the team says, sometimes it's just generic. So you got to watch to see specifically for this pitcher that's throwing that night. You got to watch to see specifically tendencies that maybe the hitter's leaning towards in the last 10 days. All things that go into it sound mundane, but it was like the quickest 2 hours of scouting report. Like, the 2 hours just flew by. So on a day I wouldn't work, I wouldn't be hitting, I'd go in, I'd stretch, I'd work out, and then I would go and I'd be loose, warm, go hit in the cage, and then I'd come in and I'd do my scouting reports from, let's say, 2 to 4, and then we would take BP around 4:15, and then be on the field for probably 30, 45 minutes, somewhere in there, depending on how long BP is. Then we'd have our pitcher-catcher meeting, so the catcher and the starting pitcher would meet. Then we'd have our bullpen pitchers meeting, where the catchers and the bullpen pitchers would all be in the same meeting. Anybody had anything? Bullpen pitchers are a little bit easier because you're usually the two-pitch guys. It's like, bring the cheese, break something off in the dirt, let's go home kind of thing. But it's one of those things where you're having all those meetings and it's just really refreshing all the things that I wrote down, all the tendencies that I saw, the things in the scouting reports, and even like stuff that I'd watch on the MLB Network. So I'm constantly like thinking and watching, even when I'm not playing. And then, you know, you're about 6 o'clock at that point, You have a little, what we call big league spread. Get a little food in your belly, a little comida. And then you go out there and you dress and you watch and you assume in the game at some point you're going to get in as the backup catcher because the starting catcher probably doesn't run well. So they're going to pinch run for him. And then you go in and you can't be cold. So it's like you spend the whole game like waiting, like a dog waiting for somebody to drop a treat. Like, where's the treat? And then it's the ninth inning, no treat. All right. So yeah, it's a long process of preparing for the games and stuff. Go ahead. Do I think the DH is coming? Yeah, I do. I think it's so, yeah, sure. I mean, I like the double switches. I like the little bit of, it's really not that big, like the strategy of the game isn't that big. The biggest thing is I think it will help pitching have less injuries, so I'm for it. Because it's not going to be dudes that are going to be running out there for one out, and then the manager's like, run them out the next night. You know, hold on. Like, you used everything you had to get out there. Yes, you only threw one inning or one out, and it still wears on you. But the whole, like, is a DH coming to National League? Like, that's my issue with the MLB. Like, they push stuff into the media that they think really matters. Doesn't really matter. They're talking about how are we going to split the billions of dollars that the industry comes in, but nobody can say that. So they say stuff like, well, let's ban the shift and let's bring the DH in. You know, that's like spitting into the pond down here and being like, hey, I filled the pond up. You know, anyway, go ahead. Yeah. No, that's a good question. And I thought I loved the game before. I've learned the meaning of love over 20 years, and I really like the game. Like, I really like it. If baseball said, I love you, I'd be like, that's nice. I really like the game. I like talking about the game. I could sit and answer baseball questions all the time. I like debating stuff. I like having the contrary opinion to whatever someone else has about baseball. But I think the game has, I couldn't have done it with the trials and like the changes and everything and how it affected my family without my faith. That was my PED. That was my performance enhancer, was the Lord. But I also, he can change the desires of our hearts. And he never changed the desire of my heart for baseball. But I know that the next thing I do, I want to use the unique ability and the unique love of an experience of the game that I have to the best of the ability. And I don't know what that's going to be. But if it's in baseball, it's going to be great because I get to be around baseball and talk baseball. If it's not in baseball, then hopefully I can... You know, I can be around kids. I can be around them playing baseball and teaching baseball. Because there's a lot of people, I have so much respect for coaches, youth coaches, because of all the time they put in. And I would love to be able to just make an impact like other people made an impact on my career and show people I'm not going to make tons of big leaguers. That's not at all feasible by me. But I do know that if I can help people like my middle school team last year who had, there was 11 kids on the team had never played catch before, maybe they'll like baseball a little bit more. We had more than 11. We had 17, but 11 of them had never played catch before. And some of them really like baseball now. And not saying that they're going to go on and have incredible baseball careers. Even the best players aren't going to go on and have, like 22,200 and, I should look up the number, but It's 22,000 some people have ever put on a big league uniform, pitched in an inning, and I'm not checking my messages. I'm not a millennial, so that would never happen. 22,564 people have ever played in the big leagues. One game, one at bat. So you're like, okay, that seems like a lot of people that have. The way it was told to me by a lawyer in the Players Association, he said anytime in New York, there's approximately 125,000 lawyers in the greater New York City area. That's like a lawyer. That's a really, like in New York, that's a big time job. And there's been 22,564 people to ever play in the big leagues. So it's really tough. And if that's your goal, great. Shoot for the stars. You might hit the moon in the meantime. Yes. When I was growing up, my baseball heroes, Mike Schmidt, and then Scott Rowland, when he, on the Phillies, because he took over third base. There was a little area in there where like Dave Hollins and like Charlie Hayes, I liked those guys, but they weren't there that long. But yeah, I remember looking up to those guys, and I email with Mike Schmidt like once, twice a year now. Like, Mike Schmidt? Like, that guy was my hero. That guy was the guy. And Scott Rowland signed a ball for me when I was in spring training with him. Spelled my name wrong, but that's okay. I still kept it. Didn't need him to put Eric on there. Yes. That's a good question. How did my family and the kids handle all the moves? Let's just push my wife aside, because she clearly demeans all of your wives, because she's the best wife and you guys all got the second place wife. But the kids really, it was different stages. Like all the moves, they didn't really care. The boys were like, this is awesome. Like, we get to go in a new clubhouse. Who's the next guy that we get to play catch with? All that stuff. And they loved that all the way up until the end, when they're crying in the back of the bus after we lost in 2020 to the Rays in game 5. And they're like, I don't want you to quit. I don't want you to quit. And I was like, okay. I was like, if you don't want me to quit, I'll keep playing. But what is that like? Would you rather me keep playing and you see me play on TV when you guys are in school, or you come into the clubhouse when you're with me, but then I miss all your games? Would you rather me come to some of your games? Oh, well, I guess that would be, I might be able to coach some of your teams. Oh, okay, well, yeah, but I still want to see, I don't know. Like, it was tough for him. It was definitely tough for him. It was, my daughter, on the other hand, I just told this story. My daughter was ecstatic. My boys are like, like crying in the back. And my wife and my daughter are sitting in the seat next to each other, and they're just like, yeah, he's done. They didn't get the clubhouse fun, the field fun, all that stuff. But my daughter was so ecstatic when I was done, 2020. But rewind back to 2017, I'm with the Yankees, and we're in the playoffs. We're playing the Indians. We were down 2-0, came back to Yankee Stadium, won game 3, and then we went game 4. If you remember, Greg Bird hit a pull homer into the upper deck against Andrew Miller in like the 7th, 8th inning, somewhere in there, and we won 1-0. So my daughter is 5 at the time. Yeah, she had her 5th birthday in New York City. She's 5 at the time. She's in the family room. And so after the game, my wife picks her up. We meet in the tunnel underneath, and we walk up into the player parking lot to go to our car. Player parking lot sounds like this, but just without a microphone. Like, it's like echo, echo, echo. And it's just the players' cars, front office. So it's a real tiny cinder block echo. Everybody hears everything. And normally we'd go up the stairway, and then I'd pick her up on my shoulders and put her on my shoulders. And as I'm picking her up, she goes, Dad, did the Yankees win? And they have the game on, but she's 5. Like, she didn't feel the stadium shaking after he hit the home run. Like, she didn't see the 2-liter bottles of soda that the fans were throwing onto the field. Like, she didn't see all the hoopla. The boys are just like, oh, this is amazing. This is the best. Aaron Judge saw me again. Like, they're, you know, they're so into it. And my daughter goes, did we win the game? Did the Yankees win? And she was on my shoulders. And I go, yeah, man. I go, we won 1-0. And she just balls. She's like, oh, no. I don't want the Yankees to win. No. And it's echoing. And I'm like, like, I don't ever play. I don't want people to think that we're cheering against. But in her 5-year-old mind, I was done playing when the Yankees lost. And she was getting a puppy, because I had told her she was getting a puppy. We ended up getting a puppy in 2020, so that's why she was juiced. She was juiced, so, yes.
Eric, you mentioned last night about what time you're going to
make. Yeah.
And I know later in your career, you know, you ever look back and say, well, maybe I should have been.
Not for a second. Nope. No, I can throw the ball hard off of flat ground. When I get on the hill, it's another level. And, you know, everybody hears about, like, Tommy John surgeries or rampant and all that stuff. In 2017, I can't straighten my elbow as straight as I make my left one. Probably just years of throwing. Well, the one morning I woke up in the offseason, I'm a free agent now, so I don't have a team. And I can't straighten it past here, and I can't bend it past there. And I'm like, oh, I go in, MRI, found a loose body. I probably have another one in there right now. Who knows? But loose body, found a loose body in there. So to your point of pitching, if I was a pitcher in that MRI that I got, I paid for myself, no teams ever saw it because I never wanted to see, let them see what was going inside my body because they're barely liking what's going on outside of my body. So went in there, and I have a 80% torn UCL. So everybody that has an 80% torn UCL that pitches, surgery. Like, see ya. Get it redone. Now you're good to go. At that point in my career, so who knows when, because the last time my elbow hurt was when I was 24. And we're talking 13 years later. So did I play with that the whole time? It definitely, from that point on, every time I pitched, I was like, maybe I shouldn't let this go. Like, knuckleballs will definitely make it feel a lot better. But, yes. Any advantage to me being tall? Yeah, I could definitely intimidate people when they said something in the box and I stood over them. It would look weird if I stood up and was like, what did you say? I think there's advantages. There's advantages and disadvantages. I think people, catching position is, as much as you have a slow slug behind the plate, it's about quickness and reaction. And so I think my height could get in the way, just like sometimes shorter catchers have different mechanical flaws that a bigger catcher doesn't get into. But it's also one of the reasons that I started throwing from my knees, being tall. And not because it was quicker. I pretty much had the same times. But the low pitch, I wanted to be able to still get the low pitch and not block the umpire out. And being taller, if I stand up, it might block the umpire out and I might lose that pitch. So there's advantages and disadvantages. Yes. Great. I had one knee surgery. And this is... You know, conspiracy theory, but you know there's evil and there's good in the world. And I had a teammate who wasn't the best teammate. He was in AAA. And my knees were really, they were great. But this guy, I won't say his name, he came from a country that that practiced Santeria. And there's what they call black Santeria, and there's what they call white Santeria. Both of them sound like they're from Satan, so, but one is like good Santeria, and one is black. It's bad Santeria. And the bad Santeria, they will, how was explained to me, and you're like, how does this have anything to do with your knees? But wait. How was explained to me, they would wish and put not spells, but like voodoo. It was essentially like voodoo on other people. And this guy practiced black Santeria. I think it was black Santeria. But anyway, I might be wrong on that, but it was Santeria. And I was running down the first baseline in Milwaukee. Ran down. It was a ground ball. Rolled over on a ground ball in the ninth inning against Francisco Rodriguez. And hit the base. Chopped down. Stopped. My last step. I stopped. And I just, like, felt like something in my knee. Like something really weird. And I kind of limped back. Could barely walk down the steps. Found out I had a torn meniscus. Catcher probably had a lot of meniscus tear. But the meniscus had actually, like the flaps that had torn, had flipped up, and it was pinching in my knee, okay? So I have the surgery. I'm back in less than 5 weeks. Not a major surgery at all, but I missed time. That catcher came up in place of me, okay? So he goes back down. He gets sent back down. I come back up, and so it's me and Chooch. Chooch calls me to the back of the bus. One trip, he said, hey, Poppy, I have to show you something. He's got, like, three crosses on. Like, he's, like, kissing them. He's, like, Freddie Galvis, who's also from Venezuela, got a call the day before and said that my name and his name, Chooch's name, were on a, whatever it is, a Santeria church. They were on the wall to be hurt. And I still get chills thinking about it. The next two seasons, this guy who went to go play for, catcher went down with torn meniscus or a torn ACL, all on freak plays running down the first baseline. Scary. If we want to talk about evil and good, scary. But no, my knees have been tremendous. I'm very, very lucky. But I also tell people, I didn't play a lot. I watched a lot of games. So that helps. Yes. Oh, difficult umpires? Something about umpires that people and even players sometimes don't understand is they're really good. Like, they're really good. No matter what, like, we saw, like, when you're trying to hit, like, it's tough to make an adjustment. Like, your eyes just, like, as you get older, your eyes just don't work quite the same. And these guys are, for the majority, are older. And they get a ton of the calls right. But some of them do stink. And most of them that stink just don't care. And so those are the ones that I'd had the toughest time with. But my favorite, I mean, Teddy Barrett is the head of the umpires for Christ. And he is just, he loves the Lord. I love Teddy Barrett. He is brutal behind the plate. He is so bad. Like, you are a brother in Christ, but you are garbage right now. Like, you can be honest. Laz Diaz always has a place in my heart because he was behind the plate for my first game, and it was a 1-0 pitch. I was facing Bud Norris. First game, I think it was my third at bat, and he's like, the inning before, he like taps me on the back and he rubs my back. He's like, we're going to get you a hit. And I'm like, all right. I'm like, I'm really not, like, I'm not stressed yet. Like, it's only two at-bats. But now that you say it, I'm a little bit stressed. But so it's 1-0, and I'm up, and Bud Norris was always throwing cutters. And he was like 92, 96, and he started on the inner half just to get ahead, and he cut it back over. You know, so it's essentially just a pitch down the middle. And he starts one that's in off the plate, cuts back on, probably hits the plate by, like, that much. Ball. He's for real. Like, he's going to get me a hit. And Bud's like, oh. Next pitch, first big league hit. So Laz Diaz always has a place in my heart. And every time I tell people that story, other players are like, Laz Diaz, he sucks. Oh, well, he got me a hit. So, but yeah, there's a lot of stories. Joe West. Everyone wants to hear a Joe West story? So we're in Florida. Justin Ruggiano is coming up to the plate. You probably don't know Justin Ruggiano, but he's very, so like matter of fact. Like he never, there's no fluff in him as a player. Joe West is behind the plate. I'm working, you know, maybe two thirds of an inning. And Joe, you know, Ruggiano might be the third batter up, fifth batter game. I'm not sure. Comes in. And Joe is talking like this the whole game, the whole time. He's like, "Ah, how you doing?" He's like, "Yeah, I missed all the spring training. They made me go down to AAA." So he had already told me all this. He had to go down to AAA. I don't know why I got to go down to AAA. Really, really like raspy voice. And I'm like, so Ruggiano comes up. He's like, Ruggiano comes up. He goes, "Hey, Justin." He goes, or no, he goes, "Hey, Joe, how you doing?" He goes, "Hey, Justin, how you doing?" He goes, "Dang, Joe." He goes, "You sound terrible." And Joe goes, "Throat cancer." He had never told me anything. He's like, "Yeah, found throat cancer." Ruggiano's like, he's like standing in the box like this. He looks back. He goes, "That sucks." And I was just like, I'm like, I've been back here however long in the game it was. And it was just like, yeah, throat cancer. He missed spring training because he had throat cancer. So that's my Joe West story. There's so many more Joe West stories, too. Go ahead. Oh, you're good? Just raising the rest. Go ahead.
Iron Pigs. What years were you there, and how did you like it?
All of them, and I loved it. He asked what years I was with the Iron Pigs. 2011, I spent the entire season there. 2012, off and on, maybe about half to a little less than half the season. 13, I was not there. And then 15, I spent a little bit of time, but
that's my team, and if I would have seen you live,
that's where I would have been. If you were a true Iron Pigs fan, you would know who I am. I am one of the greatest Iron Pigs ever. No, it was such an awesome place to play. If you haven't been to a Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs game yet, you got to go. It's a great environment. It's a little bit more spread out than Reading. Reading's a great place to watch a game, too, but I feel like Reading's like, you're in a sardine can. But yeah, Lehigh, it was great because my family was able to come up to games when I was playing, and I got all the tickets that year. They won the attendance records the year I played there because my family would show up. Go ahead. Fan trash talking. It can be good, but I always feel like you have to be a really good player, especially in the big leagues. In the big leagues, you have to be a really good player to get fans to trash talk you. Like people are like, "Oh, did they ever boo you anywhere?" No, like they were like kind of happy when I came up the other team. But like the one time I ever got booed was in Cincinnati. I got in Joey Votto's face. They booed me for my first two at-bats, and after that, they were just like, "I don't remember who it was." Like, but the best trash talk I ever heard was in college. In college, I had a guy that hit behind me named Yoder. And he was hitting in front of me. And we were playing at Christopher Newport. And so I was down at the beach, you know, not a Mennonite area at all. They're like, "Yoder? What kind of name is Yoder?" And this is my freshman year, and I'm just like, I know a lot of Yoders, like, Yoder. And they were like trying to Yoder, Yoder, lay, hee hoo, you know, they were doing a bunch of stuff. I don't remember him saying anything to me until his second at bat. I'm standing on deck, and these guys are like on the fence, and he goes, "Yoder, I'm gonna," and they go, "Hey, this guy's name is Kratz." And I'm like, "Oh, great." And the guy goes, "I'm going to take a Kratz and wipe my Yoder." And to that point, like, I felt all Mennonite churches started changing their names. Like, they were thinking about renaming gyms and stuff. But it was the best zinger that I ever, even back, you know, all the way until playing in the big leagues. That was the best one. Go ahead. Oh, with a massage gun. I didn't catch it with a massage gun. That'd be weird.
No,
Yeah. He was saying, he was asking about a story that came out for like 3 minutes about the Rockies stealing signs. You have to be really into like the dark web of Eric Kratz history to know that I called out the Rockies. But everybody knows about the Astros. And they had their sign stealing with the trash cans, banging a trash can. And in 2018, we were going to play the Rockies. You watch video enough, like even, I even did it when you guys were hitting off the machine, and like I'm like kind of evaluating who's going to do good and who's not. And I picked a couple of the guys that were going to the finals, but I could look at the machine and like see, oh, these guys are going to miss this because it's got late life and it's riding and it's going under. So your eye just sees things. And I'm watching, we're watching highlights of the Rockies. And I'm like, man, this looks like they shouldn't have stayed on that pitch. I know Nolan Arenado's really good. I know Trevor Story is really good. I know DJ LeMahieu is a batting title champ, all this stuff. But I'm watching some of the other six, seven guys that hit in their lineup, and I'm like, this just doesn't look right. This just isn't, like, you shouldn't hit this pitch. I've seen you before, and you're not that good. So you have in your mind, okay, they're cheating. Because everybody cheats to some extent. And so I'm watching it, and I show one of our advanced scouts. He's like, yeah, I really think they're either peeking or they're sending signs in, whatever it is. So we go into our series against the Rockies, one of the best offenses in baseball. We go into NLDS. They scored two runs all in the ninth inning of one of the three games that we played. The rest, they got shut down and scored nothing. But we were using multiple signs with nobody on base. And somehow they couldn't get a rally going. Somehow. So fast forward another year, I'm playing with somebody who was on the Rockies. I said, I got to ask you, were you guys sending signs in? He goes, yeah. He goes, I was sitting on the bench and they would tell me what sign was coming. And I had the Theragun. You guys know what a Theragun is? You know, the brrr. Yeah. And they would brrr on the bench. Brrr. But it didn't gain a lot of traction because Rockies lost. Like, it didn't work. Nobody cares about somebody that loses. Everyone's offended when somebody cheats and they win. So that's, and that's just one example. Like, there's a ton of examples of teams that were cheating. Yeah, the Astros, like, they got caught, but they won. There's other teams that have gotten caught. They didn't win. Like, the Dodgers had something going. The, you know, if you haven't, if you played on a team where you didn't see something that was a little bit nefarious, you probably weren't trying to win. Like, I'm pretty sure that the, you know, the Rays of the early 2000s weren't trying to steal signs and cheat. You know, but the best teams always look to do it. The Yankees, they did different things too. You know, so it's always trying to get an advantage of some kind. So if you call it cheating, then that means that team stepped over the line for you. But, yes. The crowd? Oh, you can get super energized by the crowd. But I'll tell you, if you're pinch hitting, and it was a great example of the crowd, can it affect you or not? When you're pinch hitting during the pandemic and nobody's in the stands, your heart still pounds the exact same velocity as when you have 20 at-bats in the big leagues and Charlie Emanuel is, hey, you're in. Your heart is still pounding. That adrenaline is still pumping. So the fans definitely affect it, but you do really zone them out. And so it's something that it can help you. It can bring you up when you don't have a lot of energy. Like going into Fenway, there's a ton of energy in Fenway. So that's always, you know, that always brings you up. But yeah, that's a good, yes. Mariano Rivera, never caught him. Faced him one time on a rehab assignment and didn't throw me a single cutter. Who would have thought? He didn't even need his best pitch to get me out. This was back in 2003, but no, I never played against him, never caught him. Favorite stadium to hit in? I loved hitting in Fenway. I was a good hitter in Fenway, so maybe that's why. I liked hitting in Philly in Citizens Bank. I like the small parks. Seeing the ball go over the fence when it's just a fly ball, that's the best. Yes. My take on pitchers intentionally hitting a batter. I'm really more all about, like, if you're offended, like, and you hit somebody, like, stand up to it. Like, I got no problem if you hit somebody, but don't hit somebody and be like, oh man, I slipped. Like, no, you hit somebody, like, I hit somebody. There's repercussions from it. You're going to get fined. You're going to get attacked with a guy with a helmet on, whatever it is. You know, I'm not against it. I've called it myself. It's part of the game in the sense of being able to have retribution for guys that your guys got hit, sending a message to the other team that whether they were trying to hit, whether they're trying to hit one of your batters, you got to have more control. So one of two things has to happen. The manager has to not put that pitcher in who keeps hitting guys, or that pitcher has to get the ball over the plate and stop throwing inside until he can control it. So I wouldn't say it's gamesmanship. I'm not trying to intentionally hurt somebody, but you're intentionally showing the other team, look, like, we got guys that can throw 95 too. And there's a little bit of an intimidation factor, I guess, too. Yes.
Is there a record for how many teams a player can play on?
You feel like I'm close? I personally, I'm gonna put a plaque in my own house for the record, because Edwin Jackson has the most. He's played for 13 major league teams. So he has the most. I played for 14 organizations, so I technically won. But when I went on the MLB Network, they told me it didn't count because they weren't big league teams. I was like, well, it counted every time I got moved, so just saying. Yes. From now? Could it, if I wanted to, include being a manager of a big league team? I think so, from what people told me. And being a manager is kind of a PR thing too. I've had prominent writers that everybody would know by name come up to me and be like, hey, when you want to manage, you just tell me, I'll get your name out there. And I asked the guy who's writing my book, Tim Brown, who was a prominent writer in the baseball landscape. I was like, why would they ask me that? And he's like, well, that way, then when stuff goes down with your team, they have the inside scoop with you because they pushed and sold you. And I'm like, I'm out on that. Like, that's not at all. I don't need that. But so I told all of them, I'm like, I'm not ready. I'm not ready. People in baseball have told me that if I were to go in and, you know, be a bench coach, I've had offers not to be a bench coach yet, but to, you know, be a bench coach in waiting kind of thing and be a big league coach. And I've turned them down easily. It's just not a desire of mine right now. In the next 5 years, I've told a couple people this here, next 5 years, my oldest son will be out of the house. My middle child, my son, he'll be driving. So that's essentially out of the house. And my daughter will be 13 years old. I don't meet many 13-year-old girls that really like their dads. So my time with her is right now. And then during that time, we'll revisit it. So I don't know. I don't know what it looks like. The Red Sox consulting job that I did last year is very intriguing to me because I can make my own schedule. I can commute to Reading, to Lehigh, to Trenton, to, you know, different places like that. And possibly I could get a job at the MLB Network too. So that would be awesome just for, again, for the flexibility. So, yes.
If there weren't for your major league baseball career, was there another career you would pursue?
What a good question. No, I was only going to be a big league baseball player. Duh. Don't ever have any fallback plans. I think early, right when I graduated, you know, I would have gone back and worked for my dad. And then when I was in the minor leagues, I started learning construction. So there was a time when I was like, maybe I'll do construction. But then I looked at some of the things that I built, and I was like, maybe I shouldn't do construction. I think I felt like I was more of like a good laborer than a, but I guess I would have gotten better too. But yeah, I have a business degree from Eastern Mena University. So I had a degree. I'm not sure what that would have gotten me, but I had a degree. I know I would have looked for a job to support my family. So I had a lot of interests. I've seen some of my buddies who got drafted at the same time that stayed in minor league baseball and did that route. And it's tough. Minor league coaches that don't have any big league time don't get paid anything. And you're gone. Like, unless you live in Columbus, Ohio, you know, you have to go to the team. You have to go to spring training. You're gone a lot. The coaching life is tough. I like when people ask that on, like, I had a couple teammates that were, like, you know, on the scoreboard, they ask us, what would you do if you didn't play baseball? And they're all like, well, I would have played in the NFL. No, you wouldn't have. Like, my one buddy said that, and because he had a scholarship to go to play receiver at Miami. I was like, I just watched you catch a fly ball and land and get a concussion. You would have had no shot in the NFL. He's like, what do you mean? Like, exactly. You know exactly what I mean. But a couple more. Yeah. My take on analytics. Does everybody know what analytics is? No? Okay, well, it's kind of making a swoop through baseball, basketball, soccer, and football. Like, my take on analytics is they're just putting values to the things we already knew. I'll use our little home run derby thing as an example, okay? There's a thing called TrackMan. It tracks how many times a ball spins before it gets to the plate. Tracks exactly how far it goes. They're not guessing anymore. They're not like, well, that seat looked like 420 feet away, you know, and pull a tape measure. No, it's all based on this black box that they have above home plate. Now in the big leagues, it's even more. It's like Hawkeye. They can count how many rotations the ball takes to get to the plate. It's incredible. That ball that you guys were trying to hit, and most of you not successful, it is 100% okay, because that ball had late life in my eyes, and if you stood next to it, you could see the ball just stayed straight, right? And everyone's like, you're swinging under it. But the hitters, who hit? Raise your hand. Who hit there? Besides my guy, everybody swung and missed it a lot. You were the only one that didn't swing and miss. That was impressive. Everybody's swinging and missing. Everybody's swinging and missing. Where were they? Under it. Your eye naturally, whether your eyesight's going, is gone, or still intact, your eye thinks that ball should be going down. So in 10, 12 years ago, people would have said, that ball has late life. It has ride. As softball pitchers, softball players say, oh, it's a riser. That ball's rising. Technically, the ball is not rising. The ball is just staying on the plane. But now with analytics, they are able to quantify how much that ball is riding. And so they quantify it in what's called vertical break. Every pitch has, let's say the average pitch is minus 15 degrees vertical break. -15 vertical break. So that means that each pitch is going to go down 15 units. If you have a lot of life, your pitch might only go down 0 units. So it actually doesn't go down. That, you would say, oh, that ball's rising. That's why I keep hitting, that's why I'm missing it. That's why I'm missing it. The ball's not actually rising, it's just not going down. Analytics gets to explain it in a number form. So does that make you hit it better? No. But it gives you a reference, a state of reference in your mind and your eye-hand coordination to be able to make the adjustment on it sooner. I love analytics. The part that I don't like about analytics is when they put a number to a player and that's it. Because I was telling somebody earlier, numbers don't break up with their girlfriends in the middle of the season. Numbers don't have deaths in the family. Members don't have kids who are sick and up all night, and then you got to play a day game. Numbers don't pitch 3 days in a row. Numbers haven't sat on the bench for 6 days, and then you get in there and you face Craig Kimbrell in the ninth inning. You know, those are all things that go into it that you can't quantify. And that's where the relationship, the guys that I talked about, managers, leaders, they talk to those guys and explain, hey, I need you to stay ready. I'm probably going to use you in the seventh, eighth, ninth. All three of their guys are blowing cheese at the top of the zone. I need you to be ready. Now, instead of thinking, oh, coach, manager doesn't like me. You know, oh, man, I never get to play seventh inning. Ah! And you look like you guys, the first 10 swings. That's okay. That's why I didn't come out and hit, because I knew I would have done the same thing. So there's a lot of stuff in analytics that's like that, that really is so good, it just has to be applicable to the person. Yes, somebody who hasn't had a question yet. Yes. For sure. I hear what you're saying. And, you know, being on the road is, being alone is like the worst thing that you can do if you are tempted. Because nobody else, you need accountability partners. I had a teammate that would open his door to his hotel room and whoever's next to him's door. And they'd trade each other their remotes. So he wouldn't watch any of the smut that was on TV. And so if he's in the room by himself with the remote and he's tempted, it's so just, nobody knows, you know? So those are the things that have to be done ahead of time. And as a Christian, I would talk to, especially when I was older, I could talk to these guys about being, the biggest thing that would come up in rain delays that I would talk to guys, like in AAA especially, was these guys that are on the cusp of stardom or they're in the big leagues and they think they're big time because they probably are big time, but they're single. And it's like, you know, they would see my walk, they would see my life, and I hope they felt like it was something that they wanted, and that's why they would ask me questions. And I would talk about like the decisions that they make. I said, I don't envy you guys at all being single and famous. Because you don't know what the next woman really thinks of you. If she has no idea about baseball, she's going to come and hang around the wives. She's going to know that you're a stud. And so then is she really there for you through thick and thin? Because as you heard yesterday, there's a lot of thick and thin. That's just my story, but it's for a lot of people. And I encourage them to do what I feel like has been successful for me. Make a plan ahead of time. Don't get yourself in a situation where that would happen. The whole getting married while you're in the pro, that's tough. In the big leagues as a superstar, I don't envy those guys at all, and I would encourage them to abstain from having sex with a girl because that was like, what? Like ever? I wouldn't have. Like, wait till you're married. Save it. And that was something that we talked a lot about. And it was something that some of them would come back to me and talk about it. And others would just kind of be like, you think I could really do that? I'm like, yeah, I know you can do it. And I try to encourage them in that kind of situation. But the best example of showing my Christian walk was to live out my Christian life every day. And it's vulgar, but I spent so much time with these guys. Never again in my life am I going to shower with 25 guys for 162 days out of a year. So these guys are close. They are bonded brothers. I spend more time with them than my family. So no better way than to live out my life the way I hope that Christ wants me to live out my life to them. And, you know, see what they take from it, for sure. Yes, Lester. Did I try to emulate any catchers, and who did I admire most? I started catching late, so I felt like I was a junior in high school. So, like, I still liked third baseman. Like, I still liked Scott Rowland. You know, those were my guys, outfielders, because they could run. So catchers that I really emulated, I loved watching Ivan Rodriguez play. Pudge was, I know some of you, he's not the original Pudge, but he, like, watching him was like, oh my gosh, because he could throw. I wanted to throw like him so bad. But when I started playing then, I realized that, one, I wasn't going to be as good as him. Two, a lot of the things that he did, I couldn't do. He's like this tall. So he had ability to do things that I couldn't do. So I started watching guys that were taller and started trying to see how they were successful and what they did. And I would watch like some pretty random guys like John Buck. Probably don't remember him. He had great hair like me, so we were a lot alike. But he had been in big leagues for a while. And then, you know, you watch a guy like Matt Wieters. Matt Wieters is 6'5". So I'd start watching the really tall guys and see how they did things. So, yeah. Thank you, guys.